Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and sorry to be a few minutes late. As Steve says, I'm at GW and also running a project that's a successor to the Growth Commission called the Growth Dialogue. And actually, that's what brings me to Malaysia. We just did a two-day symposium jointly with Think City in Penang on the issue of greening urban growth. So trying to put those three things together, greening, urban, and growth. And doing it with a series of panels that brought together some academics, some people from other emerging market economies, and people from the business sector. So since I'm in KL for one day, and ISIS is the only institution that I know from my past, I am delighted to be here. So what I'm going to talk about is what's happening in the global economy and what the implications might be for what we call multilateralism. And so the topic gives away a little bit the view that I have, which is multilateralism under stress. And so let me try to convince you that, that what I have to say may be true. But we shall see. So I'm going to use the typical PowerPoint presentation, but I expect that the more interesting part will be the interaction when I'm finished. So I think where I would like to start is the observation, which I think you may well agree with, that the global economic order has shifted, that it's not just a normal business cycle that happens to have been deeper than most, but rather that we may well be in a sort of a new economic situation. Some people call it the new normal, but one of those characteristics, well, the first is that the advanced economies actually are doing rather poorly. All the traditionally large economic blocks, the U.S., Europe, and Japan, are way below their potential growth rates. And this wouldn't be such a problem if it weren't also the case that these countries have been the major custodians of the multilateral system. You may or may not agree as to whether or not the multilateral system has been absolutely perfect or absolutely open, and certainly Joe Stiglitz and others have pointed out certain impediments, but it's been the system that has allowed a lot of countries to grow rapidly, and that was the essence of the Growth Commission report. So I believe that there are cracks that are appearing, and that, as I said, we're in a new world, and that sometimes we have to do some new thinking. Along with this problems in the advanced economies comes the fact that the new economic powers, I call them NEPs because I don't particularly like BRICS. I think Russia doesn't really belong in there, and South Africa's got a lot of other problems. But the new economic powers, the 10 or so that are really growing rapidly and emerging, I describe as adolescent globalists, which is not the nicest term, but I'm trying to get the point across that they are yet untested or unwilling, or perhaps they would say unable, to take up the gauntlet of keeping the multilateral system working. At the same time, the only institution that we have globally to deal with issues has turned into the G20, getting the remit from the G8. And the G20 did pretty well in 2009 in at least trying to coordinate fiscal stimulus packages around the world. They began to falter in 2010. Didn't really live up to potential, even though the Koreans did a great job of chairing. And I would say in 2011, the Europeans were so distracted that we didn't really get much out of the G20, although everything is being thrown at them. And it's hard to see that they will be able to solve them. So I believe that we may well be in for a rough ride multilaterally. Sorry. here. I need to hit this one. So just to set the stage, this depiction shows what's happening to world GDP. In the concentric circles, the U.S., Germany, and Japan and others are seeing their relative share of global GDP shrink, whereas China's is obviously increasing dramatically, although the per capita income is still relatively low. So the questions that emerge from these factoids are really a series. I'll try to give some views on each of them. The first is whether or not the export-oriented growth paradigm that has been the prevailing one in development economics and in sort of the neoclassical world in which I operated, whether that export-oriented model is still valid. And we should discuss that. Second, I think there's a lot to be discussed about China, and I have some views which may not be exactly mainstream, but China does change the game. Right? Third, which I may not spend a lot of time here discussing, is the impact of high commodity prices. It's perhaps more relevant for Africa right now. I would like to talk a little bit about capital flows, because there are new views which a decade or so ago would have been heretical, and probably if you go back to Malaysia in 1997, some of those views took a lot of heat. I'd like to talk to you about Danny Roderick's views, because I think part of the new paradigm intersects with what he's been writing about. And I'll end up with some comments on the state of politics. So let me backtrack a little bit and mention a few things having to do with the Growth Commission. So the Growth Commission was a group of 18 policymakers plus Mike Spence, the chair, Bob Solow, and I, the 18 others being policymakers from around the world, including the head of the Chinese Central Bank, Monte Galawalia, Zedillo from Mexico, people who were experienced in policymaking circles. And the remit of the Growth Commission was to look again at what was it that we could associate with high-growth economies. Now, Malaysia happens to have been one of the 13 countries that grew very rapidly over a 25-year period. By rapidly, we say, on average, more than 7%. And what was it about these economies? There was a lot of work behind the Growth Commission, which you can find at the growthcommission.org website. But the Growth Commission ended in 2008 with our report. And in a nutshell, there were certain features of the countries that grew very rapidly that we highlighted, including, and I think the most telling, had to do with the role of government, right? So there was a lot of discussion previously about whether or not governments should be at the core of development strategies, or should they just make sure that markets function and get out of the way. The view of this very diverse panel that had people from the social democratic parts of Europe to the Chicago School graduates of Latin America was that the role of government was central in guiding the economy, and that all the countries had a very strong role for government, and in fact for political leadership. It made some of the obvious points about infrastructure and investment in education. It made some remarks about equity and sustainability of growth and greater inclusiveness. We tried to make some observations about climate change, and we did say something about risk mitigation, but had we written a report a year later, we obviously would have spent a lot more time on that. We did not predict the crisis, and the report came out in 2008. But the bottom line is that it pretty much was an orthodox statement, except for our views on the role of government, which were not so orthodox. One of our members was Laura Brown from the private sector, and he encouraged us to put whatever we had to say on one page, because he said he came from the private sector and he wasn't used to reading anything more than one page. So we gave him this slide, which basically said that these were the five factors that we associated with successful economies: openness, macro stability, a vision of the future, using the private sector, and then this leadership and governance issue. Now, what's changed in the last couple of years is that, apart from the global environment changing considerably, there's also a new attraction to a role of government that goes beyond what we in the Growth Commission discussed, and it is under the rubric of state capitalism, right? If you looked at the cover of The Economist a few weeks back, it was all about state capitalism. And the argument being, well, there's this recent history of markets being under-regulated, so you may as well get the government involved early because they're going to be involved sooner or later. That it's quite difficult to reconcile politics with what's necessary in the long run. You can see that in Greece or in the United States or in other countries. Now, we felt, and after the Growth Commission report was issued, we went back and the commission was asked to keep our body alive for an extra year so we could review what we had said in light of the crisis, and I think there was a subsequent small document that came out, and we basically came back saying that we thought what we had said originally was correct, and in particular the role of government turned out to be even more indispensable in the crisis. But there are some questions emerging about what the right growth paradigm actually is, and the attractiveness of state capitalism is that, forgetting about whether the countries are democratic or not, there is an ability of a government to stake out a vision and to implement that vision with a minimum of interference. Now the question is that the model for the future? I think not, but there are a lot of benefits, and the countries practicing it have done rather well. So let me come back to the growth paradigm and flux issue and just give you a factoid, which if you believe that China's economy is $5 trillion, which is a very conservative estimate, depending on exchange rates and whatever, if China grows at 10% a year, that's almost equivalent to the rest of the world growing at 1% a year. So every year, $500 billion is added in this scenario to China's GDP, which is like creating a new South Africa every year. So, yes, China is too large to ignore. Coming out of the crisis and with very low growth rates around the world, at least in the advanced economies, it is probably true that the returns to the export-oriented strategy that we've long advocated are lower. Right? It's not to say that there's a superior model out there, but certainly the returns to it are lower. And coming out of the crisis also, there's a much greater, I wouldn't say acceptance, but at least discussion of what we used to call industrial policy. Industrial policy was always controversial. It was successful in some countries, less so in others. And there are various variants of smarter and less smart industrial policies, but essentially it indicates that governments may have a view about the future structure of the economy and that they may provide incentives in one way or the other in that direction. I think we're seeing in a lot of advanced economies various aspects of industrial policy today. So China, I've already talked about. Carl Dahlman has a new book out on, it's called Pressure Points, which talks about China and whether or not the Chinese are playing by the rules of the game. I think a lot of people are expecting that China's middle class will develop and this will be the new engine of growth, but it could take a while to get that cooking. So as I said, there are signs of industrial policy being exercised in a variety of countries. In Brazil, the biggest bank is the state bank for economic and social development, BNDES. And they are getting a lot of funding from the central government, and they have sectoral priorities. And if you can borrow from BNDES at 6% when the market rate in Brazil is three or four times that, you can influence the way the economy is working. China definitely has industrial policy based on acquisition of technology in a variety of ways. Korea, which was the poster child for some successful industrial policy in the 80s, although not universally successful, but successful enough so that in the U.S. today, a number of people have LG phones, watch Samsung TVs, and drive either Kias or Hyundais. So these things wouldn't have happened without Korea's industrial policy. So Korea, in the modern day, is following a green growth strategy. Their president is part of their stimulus package. Put forward a green growth strategy. Even the U.S. is trying, with not much success, to have a bit of industrial policy focused on renewables. The EU is providing all sorts of support for manufacturing and EU champions, as you might call it. And so it's industrial policy is less of a dirty word than it was in the past. It has some intellectual support from Roderick, from Philippe Aguillon, from Justin Lin, excuse the typo, who's the chief economist at the World Bank right now. But it really depends on how you define industrial policy and what you have in mind. Let me skip over the commodity price issue, which I think is a bit of a diversion. Coming out of this crisis, one of the interesting aspects is the fact that views on capital flows have changed. One of the most remarkable turnarounds that I've seen is in the position of the IMF on capital flows. The IMF used to be violently opposed to any kind of disincentives towards capital. Chile in the 1980s and early 90s had disincentives for short-term capital, additional reserve requirements, which was essentially a kind of a tax, which served Chile very well during the tequila crisis and the Russia crisis, bond crisis. Chile was protected. Yet, ideologically, many people were opposed, and we now see the IMF do a 180-degree U-turn, and we've seen Brazil imposing a lot of import taxes, you know, starting at 2%, rising to 4% and 6%, trying to discourage short-term flows. Turns out not to be an effective mechanism, really, for Brazil, because for a lot of other macro reasons that I can go into. But it's very interesting that one of the consequences of the crisis has been this change of view on the role of capital and whether or not countries should be more selective in their acceptance of capital inflows. One of the interesting facts that came out of our conference in Penang over the last 2 days was a question as to who's investing in green growth activities. And one of the panelists said, well, you know, let's look at the size of the bond market and let's look at, you know, what the demands are for green investments. And if you want to go beyond the bond market, you know, let's look at the sovereign wealth funds. So it happens that you have an active sovereign wealth fund here as well that's doing some nice things like funding Think City in Penang. But conservatively, sovereign wealth funds exceed $3 trillion. And in a very interesting paper by Luke Levin and Thai collaborator, that look at who invests in what types of investments the sovereign wealth funds are engaged in, the answer is they're highly concentrated in the energy sector and in a few countries. So you would say that sovereign wealth funds are essentially doing a lot of brown, somewhat dirty investments. Dirty, not in the corrupt sense, but more in the what sector they're involved in. I had this in here for another purpose from a different presentation, because people frequently focus on development assistance, official development assistance, and, you know, where is it going, how much, et cetera, et cetera. And the volume of official development assistance is about $120 billion. Sovereign wealth funds are 30 times that size. So if you really wanted to make an impact on development finance, you would perhaps like to mobilize some of these sovereign wealth funds to a different purpose. Now, let me turn a little bit to Danny Roderick, who's a very prolific and provocative economist at Harvard. In his most recent book on globalization and democracy, he says that there's an impossible trilemma, right? This comes out of the trilemma discussion of monetary policy. But he says, look, you can't achieve the following three objectives at the same time. You can't have a democracy, you can't follow national objectives and try to optimize them, and at the same time exercise your full multilateral responsibilities. You can do two out of three, but you can't do all of them, right? You can do the multilateral as well as national objectives, but you can't necessarily be bound by democracy, so that could be the case of China, right? You can be democratic and pursue national policies, but then you have to, you know, give a bit on what you need to do multilaterally. So if this is true, I mean, it's a conceptual argument in an extreme form, but if this is true, it doesn't speak well for the future of multilateralism, particularly if you are in favor of democratic outcomes. You could take this analogy and very easily apply it these days to Greece, right? There are a number of commentators in the FT and elsewhere that have talked about whether or not Greece's democracy is consistent with what it needs to do in the long term, which is the equivalent of the multilateral, because for them the multilateral is the EU, and at the same time pursue national interests. So I believe that multilateralism is under stress, and that the G20 are being asked to do more than they can in an environment in which some of the policy choices have gotten worse, right? We're in an environment globally with much higher unemployment, much higher debt, much lower growth, and a lot of the trade-offs are a lot less attractive than they were during 2000 to 2007, which was a period of rapid growth in trade, low interest rates, relatively low inflation, some problems in the energy sector, but basically a very benign period for the international global environment. What indications do we have that multilateralism is not doing well? Well, obviously the Doha round failed, and the arrows show you how long it's taken to negotiate the various GATT or WTO agreements, and this one took a long time and didn't yield much. A bit of a digression, but I think that there are a number of big trends that are out there which will shape the global economic debate going forward. And the reason I put them here is because a lot of them involve externalities. And if they involve global externalities, you'd like to have some multilateral or international global way to deal with them. right? So urbanization and demographics. Well, we know that urbanization is proceeding at a rapid clip. We know that, you know, demographics among the social sciences is the most predictable, except for wars and diseases. You pretty much know who's going to be short of people and who's going to be in surplus. And there are a lot of implications for both these phenomena. The urbanization phenomena, as we were discussing in this Penang conference, has a lot of implications for the climate change discussion because most of the GNP, most of the people, most of the jobs are increasingly in cities, and therefore also the emissions are in cities. And if you want to make some progress on climate change, you're going to have to do it within cities. Demographics, well, for the obvious reason that the international issue coming out of demographic trends is migration, and you need some international ability to deal with migration, or even temporary migration. Climate change, I don't have to talk about. It's clearly, you know, the major challenge of the next 20 or 30 years. Economic imbalances, I mean, this was the big issue prior to the crisis, particularly between the U.S. and China, but now we see it within the EU, right? I mean, the analogy is Germany is to the EU what China is to the global, which is they're producers of unsustainably large surpluses, and the question is how do you deal with that in a political sense? The other big trend, of course, is the shifting economic power. Now, whether China surpasses Europe or the U.S. in a particular year is not really the issue. The issue is that between now and when that occurs, there are a lot of shifts that are occurring based on changing economic power. So China's power as a commodity importer and as an influence setter on prices is pretty clear. China's role as a shock absorber in the recent crisis was also very clear. So, I mean, that trend is pretty straightforward. I think there is a sense to which nationalism is, economic nationalism, I would call it, is resurging at the same time as a lot of the multilateral institutions, but not in terms of entities, or the multilateral framework is playing at the same time as nationalism is rising. Nationalism is rising because a lot of the domestic circumstances are a lot less favorable. Right? So if you look in Europe, you look in the U.S., you look in Japan, the domestic situation is not one that allows politicians to do the right thing, right, or makes it more complicated for them to do the right thing. And I think there's an asymmetry in the public in many countries between what they expect and what's really out there. I was trying to put together some lessons. I don't think this slide does it, so let me move to the next one. I'd like to leave you with a few main messages. I will come back and say a few words about each of them, but the main messages I want to leave you with are, number one, I think that economic growth will be a lot harder to generate in the next 5 to 10 years than it has been in the past. That has serious implications for multilateralism. Related to that, global competition, I think, will be much more fierce, which means that everybody is going to be struggling to benchmark themselves, get more competitive, and fight for that more limited amount of global growth that is occurring. I think that it's pretty clear that government's role is even more important than we thought in the past, not only as a guide to future economic prosperity, but also as a regulator, as a guarantor and a lot of, and to deal with externalities both domestically and abroad. So the way government exercises that role, I think, will be key. Fourth, there's been a lot written recently, including by Mike Spence, on global convergence. I think most of you can imagine the graphs that show the convergence of income between different groups of countries. China obviously dominates, but even if you take China out, there is global convergence. The counterpart, however, is that it is coming at the cost or at the same time as, I don't claim there's causation, but at the same time as you have increasing internal inequalities in a lot of countries. Right? So if you looked at the U.S., for example, in 1978, the top 1% of the U.S. income distribution commanded roughly 8% of national income. And in 2007, roughly 30 years later, but before the crisis, the top 1% commanded 23.5% of national income, and it's probably more than a quarter today. So when you hear about the 99 versus 1 kind of debate, it's because the distribution of income has gotten considerably worse. So I believe that multilateralism is under stress, and I think the global institutions are relatively poorly positioned to deal with it. WTO, pretty much dead in the water. IMF has had a resurgence in the last couple of years under Strauss-Kahn. It's gotten refunded, but there are a lot of parts of the world that won't go to the IMF. This part of the world is one of them. Europe is not, you know, is conflicted, right? They wanted to settle their own internal problems with Greece, only to realize that they did everything wrong, right? It's a perfect Harvard case study. If you want to go back and look at how the Europeans have handled the Greek crisis, they've done everything that no self-respecting minister of finance of an emerging market country would ever do. Right? It's like every mistake possible, they've done it. And the IMF is in a sort of secondary role. So, World Bank, I've come from there, so I shouldn't say much about them, but they are, as a global financier, of decreasing importance. And they have not, in my view, taken up the challenge of climate change to the level that is required. So I think we're sort of short of international institutions to deal with many of the areas that we are facing, ironically, at a time when global externalities, negative externalities, are much higher than before, starting with climate change, but also migration, drugs, crime, you name it. There are issues out there, and it's not clear that we have the institutions to deal with them. Now, one institution I haven't mentioned is the OECD. The OECD is what I call the rich club, which I hope Malaysia will join one of these days, because it's a nice place to visit, and it's a nice thing to say that you're a member of the OECD. But the little circles show you the recent countries that have joined, except for the red one, have joined the OECD. They've done it at per capita incomes ranging from 4 to 12,000. But they've been relatively small economies. We have China, which are with a per capita income that is much lower, so it's not, quote-unquote, ready for the rich club, but its economy is so large, and the way China behaves so important, that one may well want China in this club for no other reason than one would like China to be playing by the same set of rules as some of the other economies, even though they're not there in terms of per capita income, but they're there in terms of size and influence, and I think they will have a big impact on how the system evolves, right? The fast-growing countries benefited very much from the open system. Now it's up to them, in fact, to help maintain it. In the interest of time, let me conclude that I think globalization undergoes significant changes. We're in for a rough ride. I think that these new economic powers in the OECD countries need to find some other mechanisms to function outside of the G20. Not that the G20 is not a good group, but it's not. It was not constituted, and it is not empowered to do a lot of the things that need to be done. I already mentioned that I think we're short of global institutions to deal with it. I think that national interests are at the forefront of many political leaders' minds these days, right? The Europeans focused totally on Europe. The U.S. focused on high unemployment. Japan, 15-year recession. It's hard to get the international attention from these advanced economies that are in trouble at the same time that the new emerging powers are not yet ready, able, or willing to take up the gauntlet. And as I say, we're facing more externalities, and we're underinvesting in multilateralism. Thank you.